Hello, my name is Mary Bullard. My bar number is 39382, and I represent the appellant, Mr. Raymond Betts. I'd like to focus my argument today on the issue of whether the district court committed reversible error by failing to suppress evidence obtained from Mr. Betts' warrant search and seizure. The challenge for cause issue and the lower court's error in that regard has been thoroughly established in the briefs, and we believe that it constitutes sufficient grounds alone for reversal. But if the court has any questions in that regard or with regard to any of the other issues, I'd be happy to address those now. Anything right off the bat?
Well, Ms. Bullard, what legal significance, if any, is there with regard to the time that had elapsed between the earlier car chase and when the police later attempted to contact Mr. Betts?
Well, I believe it's significant in the sense that the officers, if they truly believe that they had probable cause at the end of the car chase, you're saying between the car chase, the end of the car chase, and
when they eventually made contact.
Because in between, they did make contact with Ms. Betts.
Right.
Right?
I'm talking about Mr. Betts.
So in between simply the car chase and the contact with Mr. Betts, at the end of the car chase, they knew the officer was familiar with the license plate, so he believed that the car belonged to a particular house. And he knew, or he believed that the person driving was male, though he was a little bit uncertain on that fact. And so that's what he knew at that time. And that in and of itself wasn't sufficient to establish really reasonable suspicion even, let alone probable cause, that Mr. Betts was in fact the driver. So if in fact, the fact that time elapsed during that period and the officers didn't take the time then to try and obtain a warrant, if they believed that that was sufficient evidence alone, then they would have taken the time, I would assume, to go and get a warrant and attempt to facilitate that process instead of trying to conduct a warrantless arrest some hours later. So I guess that would be the significance I would check.
And even if there was some basis akin to a Terry stop for them to initially question him, is it your position that that changed during the course of the contact?
Well, I believe that this contact did not amount to an investigatory stop simply because of the scope of the stop and the force that was used far exceeded what is constitutionally permissible. Because what happened here is the officers show up at the home and they encounter no one at the home. They turn to leave. They hear a man asking why they're there. And then they turn around and aim their guns at him. And from that period on, Mr. Betts is confronted with weapons the entire time. And he is ordered at gunpoint off his roof of his home to the ground. The officers did not attempt to simply turn around and...
Excuse me, Counselor, this was 10 at night, wasn't it?
It was later in the evening, yes. I think it was I believe it was about 10.
Didn't just really nicely ask him to leave, did he?
No, true.
So how do you factor that in?
I don't think the fact that a man is standing on his roof asking officers why they are in his yard constitutes sufficient grounds for someone to point a gun at him. I simply don't think that's sufficient grounds, given the time and given the fact that he doesn't appear armed and that he's shirtless, and he's on his roof, apparently, and he's given his identifying information, and he's, telling them why he's on his roof, that he's looking for his cat, which, however, whatever the explanation is, the fact of the matter is that those facts presented do not justify the use of force. If in fact they had simply turned around and started to have a conversation with him and an interview with him, and they really did intend to simply investigate the alleged vehicular looting that had occurred and see whether or not there was any tie there, they could have done that without pulling guns on him, ordering him off the roof. And if, the fact that he's on the roof presented such a threat that they, I know one of the officers said or characterized it as a tactical advantage. So I really don't understand what a shirtless man alone on his roof, apparently unarmed, how he can pose some kind of a tactical advantage against two fully uniformed officers. I really, that's beyond me. But if they needed to order him off the roof, at that point, he followed all their commands. He told them who he was. He explained, he answered their questions as to what he was doing, and he got down. And then at that point, they put their guns down and exchanged them for another weapon, a taser, and handcuffs, and asked him to approach them. And this, really what we're dealing with here is an arrest. It was not an investigatory stop. It really, given the circumstances, that's what it was. And the kind of force that was used required probable cause, and they didn't have that at that point.
Let me go back to the time period when he's on the roof and they confront him when he's on the roof. When the trial court made its findings, did it make any findings about whether the police at that time were justified in what they were doing for purposes of either officer safety or safety of others? Were there any findings about that? And I'm just focusing on that period of time, not when he ultimately comes down.
I believe the court made some findings, but they were more general in nature and said that the officers were justified simply in arresting him. They were kind of vague and generalized. I don't think there were, as I recall, findings to the fact that the use of force was justified because of any threat posed. The officers said that they pulled their weapons on him. They testified that it was because he was in a tactically advantaged position and that he was acting odd because he was on his roof at night. You know, but honestly, anyone has the right to be in their yard, in their curtilage, in their house, or on their roof if they care to be, and that in and of itself is not a criminal action, or in any way poses what I think a reasonable person would think would be a threat. So that would be, that I believe is what the record reflects as to their testimony and the court's findings. But again, I think what we should focus on here is the fact that, you know, he was seized at the moment they pointed their guns at him and ordered him and made several commands asking him to identify himself, what he was doing there, and ordered him off the roof at gunpoint. At that point, they didn't have the right to do what they were doing at that point without having probable cause first. The facts here presented did not justify, are not, you know, reflective of, there are not any specific facts or circumstances that would indicate he posed a danger to them that would cause a reasonable police officer to resort to that kind of force. And, again, we're dealing with a barefoot, shirtless man who had shown them his hands and had made no furtive gestures and was complying with their orders. But even so, if they wanted to investigate, they could have had a conversation with him on the roof or asked him politely to come down. And the fact that he reacted to their excessive use of force after, you know, being ordered down and being ordered to put his hands behind his back by attempting to peacefully walk away, I believe that the inquiry really stops before they even order him to do that and pull out the tasers. I think at that point they didn't have the probable cause to order him off the roof or doing any of that. But the fact then that we get to that point and he turns and walks away, again, he's not posing a threat. He's not. He's simply saying, I don't, you know, he's physically saying or implying, I don't want to talk to you. I don't want to have anything to do with this. And I want to walk away. And at that point, if they wanted to arrest him, you know, prior to that point, they needed to have probable cause. And him walking away cannot be considered as part of the rationale for why they could arrest him, since they needed to have probable cause at the time that they pointed their guns at him while he was on the roof. That would be our position in any case. And then again, you know, probable cause didn't exist here because the car that was involved in the prior chase was owned by Mrs. Betts, not Mr. Betts, and they knew that when they got there. Several other persons they knew had access to the vehicle in addition to Mr. Betts, and one of those persons who normally had access was also a male. It was his daughter's boyfriend. And then we have, of course, Ms. Betts' speculation and as to, well, it must have been him or, you know, it could have been him. But they also knew, even though she said that, they knew that she had also said that she was asleep at the time, that she had no idea, you know, that it had happened while she was asleep and that Mr. Betts had gone to sleep with her, taken a nap that afternoon. And when she woke up, he was gone. So she never actually saw him get into the vehicle, and her statement was simply speculation. And, you know, according to Polander, you know, a mere hunch or intuition or, you know, mere speculation can't be the basis for reasonable suspicion, let alone probable cause, which, given the use of force, the number of officers and circumstances here, we believe was required and needed to be established before they could take the actions that they took. And
if it did amount to reasonable suspicion, is your argument then that even if it did, that the investigatory stop while he was on the roof was not reasonable?
Yes. I believe that it far exceeded the scope of a reasonable investigatory stop, and that's why it didn't constitute an investigatory stop, or one of the main reasons is because an investigatory stop has to be limited in nature, you can't use the degree of force here. They're basically commanding him at gunpoint to come up down off the roof and answer questions. I mean, that is custodial interrogation, and that even under Terry created a limited exception to the Fourth Amendment requirement for probable cause, and where a seizure exceeds the scope permitted in Terry, probable cause is needed. And police can't verify their suspicions by means that approach conditions of arrest, and that was established by Dunaway v. New York and in Royer. Reasonable suspicion of a crime is insufficient to justify custodial interrogation, even if the interrogation is investigative. And we would argue that the facts known to the officers at the time did not support reasonable suspicion, let alone probable cause. After all they knew, again, was that the car that had been eluding officers earlier belonged to a male, or had been driven apparently by a male, that it belonged to Mrs. Betts, not Mr. Betts, and that Mr. Betts was among four persons who normally drove the vehicle, but of course, who knows if the vehicle could have been stolen, et cetera, at that point. There's there's no reason to necessarily infer that the people who normally drove the vehicle would be the persons who were eluding the officers in that vehicle earlier.
That wouldn't be an assumption, would it?
I believe it would be a leap, but in any case, as we were saying, even if reasonable suspicion existed here, even assuming that, for the sake of argument, if that were the case, the type of encounter that occurred here was far exceeded permissible scope, simply because the circumstances didn't justify the use of force that was engaged in here. And with that, I'll reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you. You've got 2 minutes and 47 seconds.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Joseph Michaels, attorney registration number 40403. I'm here today on behalf of the people of the state of Colorado. I actually want to start first and just discuss very briefly the challenge for cause issue. And I think a helpful way to look at this is a comparison of opposites. And to do that, the opposites I want to look at are People versus Merrow, People versus Blackmon, and People versus Hancock, all of which are cited in either the opening brief or my answer brief. Merrow is the case where prospective juror indicated very strong feelings against drugs, and if drugs were involved in any sort of crime, then affirmative defense would not be permissible. And the Court of Appeals held that this compelled an inference despite any rehabilitation and despite any sort of understanding of the presumptions accorded to the defendant. The juror adamantly said, "I can't apply that. I can't apply the law. I have these feelings. They're too ingrained." And that was an abuse of discretion. So that compelled dismissal, and the trial court abused its discretion in not doing so. Blackmer, said that the prospective juror, like here, said, "I would have to hear from the defendant." But unlike here, the prospective juror said, "In order to have a fair verdict, I have to hear from the defendant. Otherwise, I would have doubt. I have to hear the balancing act. I have to hear that extra information from the defendant. Without hearing the defendant, I could not be fair." We don't have that here. And before I get to exactly what we have here, I want to also look at Hancock, which I believe Judge Loeb, you authored several years ago. And Hancock said that counterbalancing information or a discussion by the trial court listing its reasons on the record of why the juror would have been fair was required. And that's what we have here. Here we have a juror who said, "I understand the law. I can apply it. I would wonder, but I could still be fair." And that makes this case much closer to People versus Phillips, which is also cited in our briefs, where the defendant indicates that, or where the prospective juror indicates, "I think the defendant might have something to hide if he doesn't testify, but I can apply the law, then it's okay, and the trial court doesn't abuse its discretion by denying
it." But isn't the case here, and I do know a little bit about the Hancock case, there and here, you didn't have any rehabilitative questioning, so you had none of that. It is true that in Hancock, you didn't have the kind of findings that the court made here. But isn't the issue here a different one? Isn't the issue whether the record supports the trial court's findings? And that was not an issue in Hancock.
That's correct to a point. Hancock didn't have a record at all about the juror and the trial court's interpretation of the juror. And in Hancock, the juror was much more extreme. I can't remember exactly what the juror was saying about Hancock. But the trial court made no findings, and the juror said the defendant is guilty if he doesn't prove his innocence. And that's just not what we have here. We have a juror saying, I would be curious, and I would wonder why the defendant wasn't testifying. And that's like Phillips. And Phillips says, that's fine. And Phillips goes on and talks about how the juror said, I can apply the law. And here we have the juror saying, I can apply the law. I understand the law. And you counterbalance that with the information that the trial court had here in evaluating the juror and being able to test the juror's responses that the trial court put on the record saying, I see that this juror's disposition is much more likely to be fair. And then you go through the voir dire, you have to look at the entire voir dire to see how badly the trial court would have whiffed. And this trial court dismissed 12 other jurors over the course of the entire voir dire, including one who unequivocally stated, I understand this presumption. I understand that the law, I can't apply it. And that's right contemporaneous with the discussion of the juror under issue here, juror six.
As an aside, did you notice the author of Black Mirror?
I did notice the author of Black Mirror, and I was unprepared to see you on this panel today, otherwise I would have tried to name drop you as well. I'd like to go over to the suppression issue unless either of you, any of you have more questions about it. Suppression, it's the people's position that there was probable cause. It's the people's position that even if there wasn't probable cause, there was reasonable suspicion. And finally, even if there was neither of those, which stretches the imagination, any error was completely harmless. And I'm going to talk to the harmless very quickly first, and that's we have another witness who identified the driver as Mr. Betts. And this witness identified the driver from being stopped at a stoplight next to him and then seeing him drive off erratically after having come up behind her at a rapid rate of speed. I'm not going to go into that too much farther. We know how close cars are when they're stopped at stoplights, approximately 5 feet away. So it's not that hard to identify somebody from a photographic lineup. The facts that I want to look at, and that I think this would help this court, is that we have the officer who initially pursued, let's just say the Buick for right now, the officer pursued the Buick, noted the handicap label on the Buick's license plate, said he knew the license plate, knew it belonged to the Betts residence, ran the license plate, found out that yes, indeed, it belonged to the Betts residence, and from that, he went and directly to the Betts residence, as you pointed out, and talked to Mrs. Betts. Well, Mrs. Betts was at home, but Mr. Betts was not. Neither was the Buick. Mrs. Betts then said that the defendant was upset. He had been in Greeley earlier that day. And she said the daughters didn't have the car. Why did she say that? Well, she said that because the daughters were out doing something else, which means that the daughters didn't have access to the car, nor did the daughter's boyfriend. That's on page 676 of the record. So then the police leave, and shortly later at 10 o'clock, they are called back by Mrs. Betts, who picks up the phone and says, my husband is back at home. When they get there, looking at this from the officer's perspective, the house is completely dark at 10 o'clock. They're dealing with somebody who has just driven around with reckless disregard for the public safety in a small town, downtown Eaton, which the defendant, bless you, which the defendant evidently knew very well. And so they're apprehensive to begin with. They get up to the house, they knock on the house.
Mr. Michaels, if I may, by the time they came back at 10 o'clock, any exigency was gone, right? I mean, they had long ago abandoned their chase.
But they were invited back, and they were still looking into seeing who was the driver.
And then Mr. Betts uninvite them, effectively?
No, Mr. Betts said something colorful to the effect of, from the rooftop, yelling at them, what the F dot 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 are you doing here? I don't wish to swear at this court today. And so the officers were immediately feeling threatened, as anybody would be under such circumstances. they pulled back. They asked him what they were doing. They trained their guns on him. And they asked him to come down. At that point, they still had probable cause. The issue of whether they had a warrant was never raised at the trial court below, and it's not raised here on appeal either. We're not talking about the correctness of not having received a warrant, if that answers your question.
Yeah, I guess I want to know whether you're claiming that there was still some exigency that required them to be there at 10 o'clock at night.
I think so. The exigency was, first of all, putting aside the fact that the warrant issue is waived since we didn't talk, it wasn't raised below or in any of the briefs. The exigency is that the car was still missing when they arrived there at first. And even when they first got there, the car was still missing. They were wondering what the danger to society was, what the danger to the greater public was. In this case, we had somebody driving a several-ton vehicle around in a maniacal fashion, potentially running over pedestrians to the effect where the officers actually had to discontinue the chase. So they were going there to see what the problem was and to determine who was driving that vehicle. The defendant's argument here is sort of twofold and not really addressing probable cause fully, I don't think. One is that the officers use excessive force, which isn't particularly accurate given the circumstances. And two, that seems to suggest that it was the prosecution's burden to disprove that he, Mr. Betts, was the driver of the car and not somebody else. Betts is saying, it could have been my wife, it could have been my daughter, it could have been my daughter's boyfriend, but that's not what the prosecution has to do to prove probable cause. Prosecution does not have to offer exonerating proof of suspects to disprove the defendant's theory. They have to establish that there's probable cause to contact this particular defendant. And that's there are two Supreme Court cases that say that, as People versus Clark and People versus Bennett.
The trial court here, as I understood it, when it made its rulings, held that there was reasonable suspicion when Betts and the officers contacted each other while he was on the roof. But then later on, they had probable cause to arrest him. Is that what the trial court held?
That seems to be, but the trial court didn't say it quite like that. The trial court said, at minimum, there was reasonable suspicion. So it just went with that minimum threshold to say that was enough.
What's your position?
My position on appeal is that there was probable cause.
From the beginning.
And even if there wasn't, there was certainly reasonable suspicion. And actually, thank you for reminding me. The trial court, you asked about what its findings were, and it said that immediately upon contact with Mr. Betts, he was erratic, confrontational, threatening, and shirtless and sock-footed on a roof, but that doesn't necessarily mean that there's no gun up there on the roof with him. I'm sure we've all seen cases where, in fact, defendants have guns up there, and from the officer's perspective, they don't know that he doesn't. What the officers do know is that somebody's driving erratically, so they have to contact him and look into the welfare for the public. When they got down, he refused a lawful order to approach them and put his hands behind his back, and you just can't do that. Even if ultimately a trial court finds that probable cause doesn't exist, the defendant has no, and this sort of segues into the obstruction of a police officer issue, but a defendant doesn't have the right to refuse a lawful request that's made under color of the police authority.
He doesn't have a right to tell, to effectively communicate, whether it's by saying, I don't want to talk to you, or by walking away. He doesn't have a right to say, I don't want to talk to you.
Not once they say, come over here or put your hands behind your back.
In his own home? That's your position?
Well, the position is, the defendant's argument is the police weren't arresting him lawfully, which is debatable, but let's just keep on with that. Therefore, he was required to walk away. The defendant is not allowed to respond to unreasonable search and seizures with threat and then rely on a subsequent application of an exclusionary rule.
A threat that he respond with?
Oh, he responded by ignoring the police officer, which he just can't do. That's under Dempsey. That's under People versus Brown. That's under People versus, I'm going to butcher this name, Lenzieri. And he was going into his home. It was dark. He had already been threatening behavior. The officers knew that he had access to guns. Whether or not he had guns in his house, they didn't know. But they were trying to contact him. And even though it's in his own home, they were there by the defendant's wife's invitation. And they were contacting him from the beginning about the vehicular routing.
So I want to put this, I understand, when they asked him to put, I guess, his hands behind his head and come toward them, is he under arrest at that point in time?
I would say he's not free to not comply with that, that behavior. He's not been said, you're under arrest.
You don't have to say you're under. From a legal standpoint, was he under arrest at that point?
From a legal standpoint, I would say yes, he probably was under arrest. And even if he wasn't, there was at least probable cause to detain him. Whether or not he's fully seized within the meaning of the Fourth Amendment is a different question. But Dempsey and People versus Brown deal with issues very similar to this, where a defendant simply refuses to comply with an officer's request, and then he seeks to walk away, or he seeks to ignore their lawful requests that are made under their authority as police officer. And Dempsey specifically says physical interference for the purposes of obstruction doesn't have to be physical contact. It can be walking away. It can be ignoring a police order. The threat of physical interference is enough. And that's for a completed obstruction of justice. This we have just a substantial step towards it because it's an attempted obstruction of justice.
I'm trying to understand the logical. That's the case at that point, then is the argument that they have probable cause to arrest him for obstructing a police officer?
Well, that's something that we don't. Sorry, can you repeat that question?
Okay, so they give him this order, he disobeys it, and you say he can't disobey it under the case law.
Sure.
If that's the case, then does that then give the police probable cause to arrest him for?
I think under Dempsey, refusing to comply with police orders, and in this case, physically removing himself from the situation and walking away, does. I think that's what Dempsey does say, and I think People versus Brown reiterates that very, very directly, that a defendant may not respond to any unreasonable search or seizure with removing himself from the situation and then say, oh, you know what, you guys were wrong, you guys were right, so I shouldn't have walked away. I see that I'm out of time, so the people ask that you affirm the convictions in all respects.
Thank you, Mr. Mike.
Thank you.
To begin with the juror issue, you have to remember that this juror said that he might take direction from the judge, when asked what if the judge told you that you needed to disregard the fact that someone didn't testify? And he stated that I might take direction from the judge, but on the other hand, I think there would still be something in the back of my head, and I would still think about it. And then, particularly if there was, he was saying that if it was a really close case and he wasn't sure if the prosecution had met its burden, then he would certainly use it against him. So what we have here is a man saying that it looks like somebody has something to hide. It looks like, he should, if it was me, I would want to get up there and prove that it was me, that I didn't do it, that I was innocent. And then he goes and says that he would disregard, basically, the judge's instructions because it would still linger in the back of his head no matter what the judge told him. So I think under those facts, especially without any rehabilitation indicating otherwise, we have here a juror who would simply not, who would not follow the law and had expressed a bias. And so he should have been excused. But with regard to the suppression issue again, as you were saying, the time frame does again indicate that there was no exigency, which I don't believe that the Attorney General argued below that exigency was supported the officers pointing their guns at Mr. Betts on his roof. But we're certainly not dealing with a fleeing suspect, and we're, you have to remember too that vehicular looting or chase involves two parties. Obviously erratic driving, presumably the reason that officers call off their chase in order to preserve public safety is because once they stop following the suspect and attempting to apprehend him, he'll stop driving erratically. In any case, here, there's nothing to establish that he continued to drive throughout the night, you know, in an erratic manner, and therefore that they needed to do something immediately to stop him by, you know, coming back to his home. The reason they came back to his home was because Mrs. Betts called dispatch because they had asked her if she came into contact with Miss Betts or had further information to call them. And when they arrived at the house, Miss Betts was apparently not present, and they only ran into Mr. Betts, and Mr. Betts asked them why they were on his property, which is something that he was well within his rights to do. If he was under arrest, as the Attorney General concedes at the time that he was ordered off of his roof, then they needed probable cause, and they didn't have probable cause at that point. When he was asked to put his hands behind his back, he had not been, at that point, if he's under arrest, then later on, he continues to walk towards his house. That's an action that occurs after the point that he's under arrest. And you can't use something that occurs after an arrest has been effectuated to justify the arrest itself.
Thank you, Ms. Bullitt.
Thank you.
So, thank you to both counsel for your very helpful arguments. Case will stand submitted. An opinion will issue in due course.